You're listening to We Dig Plants on Heritage Radio Network. We're broadcasting from two shipping containers that have been repurposed into a recording studio with a garden on top. And we're in Bushwick, Brooklyn, next to Roberta's Pizza at 261 Moore Street. Today, we have a great guest, Donna Dorian. Donna was a former editor at Garden Design Magazine and now a contributing editor to that same magazine. Her writing has been featured in Arts and Antiques, Town and Country, House Beautiful, Southern Accents, and Interior Design Magazine. She's just written a new book called At Home in Tennessee, Classic Historic Interiors, and she basically sets the bar for house and garden style overall, both interior and exterior. Additionally, she is on the board of Manitoga, which is Russell Wright's design center, and she's a member of its landscape committee. And that's what we're going to focus on today: modernism, Manitoga, Russell Wright, and his fabulous garden.
Welcome, Donna.
Hello, hello.
Well, I'm going to talk a little bit briefly about Russell Wright and who he was. Russell Wright was an industrial designer. In fact, he actually helped to formulate the whole field of industrial design in America, which started to take shape in the late 1920s. His simple, practical style was influential in persuading ordinary Americans to embrace modernism in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. And he is best known for his colorful American modern dinnerware.
Which I love.
If you find it somewhere, pick it up.
Grab it.
It was made of earthenware and manufactured between 1939 and 1959, and it sold more than 250 million pieces, making it the most widely sold American ceramic dinnerware in history. That's astounding, isn't it?
It's awesome.
Considering the population then.
And it's gorgeous.
Now, you know it. You find it online. You find it at flea markets across America. The pieces were designed with biomorphic organic shapes with vaguely spherical hints of the forms of biology. And in fact, today, collectors pay high prices for rare pieces. One of Wright's Oceana wooden trays sold recently on eBay for $2,300,
$2,500. I bought that. Don't tell my husband.
For me? My birthday? Other more common items like cups from the more popular lines can be found for like $3 at flea markets. He was devoted to simplicity and natural materials and forms, and Wright also designed top-selling wooden furniture, spun aluminum dining accessories, and textiles with the mass production mentality of the engineer. And his products were not made for the elite, but the middle class. Wright's trademarked signature design aesthetic was the first to be identified with lifestyle marketed products, paving the way for personality-driven lifestyle empires such as Martha Stewart, Ralph Lauren, and others.
And every other Yahoo. And us.
Well, and in 1941, he and his wife Elizabeth purchased 75 acres of land in Garrison, New York, on the eastern side of the Bear Mountain Bridge, about an hour from Manhattan. After the death of his wife in 1952, and certainly by the 1960s, when his new ethereal line of pottery distanced him from the marketplace, he increasingly retreated to his woodland property and started creating an ecologically attuned woodland garden there called Manitoga, which means place of the Great Spirit. And it is one of the least known modernist monuments of landscape architecture. And that's why we wanted to talk about it today. Donna, can you tell us a little bit about the principles that guided Wright's designs?
Well, let me say how happy I am to be here. Thank you for inviting me. Wright was really holistic in his manner of design, and it was very important to him in everything that he did to relate what he was doing to what was around it, to see how everything interacted together. And that's really important in a landscape, mm-hmm. just as much as it is on a kitchen counter. Mm-hmm. He was very much into design of all forms. When he would create his plates, it was all about how he started with how does food look on the plate? And how does the food on the plate relate to all the other things on the table? That gave birth to his textile line.
So an artist in every sense.
Yeah, but that idea of interrelating everything, really was the same thing that he did at the garden. So there wasn't a separation between at least the principles that guided his work as a designer and a landscape designer. But, you know, if you take that sort of specifically and look at Manitoga, where you have to begin is, where is Manitoga? Very specifically, that means in the Hudson High Lines, which is historically a really interesting, interesting place. And, you know,
it's, that's the Algonquin Indians.
The Algonquin Indians settled there and lived there for centuries until we started invading them and
those
murdering them and pushing them out of there.
But we brought them pottery. little recompense, right?
But Hudson River School, Thomas Cole, that's such a rich history of land.
And also what's becoming more and more evident there is that in the late 19th century, a lot of the rich industrials moved up there and created these huge mansions.
Estates, right.
And what they did in addition to that was they saw the damage that was already being done to the landscape in terms of logging, and formed the first, it became the birthplace of the American conservation movement. You have the Harriman State Park, which a lot of us have been to or certainly know about. But there was also the creation of the view shed of the Palisades.
Exactly.
Yes. Can you imagine how ugly it would be if there was Hoboken peeping out of the parapet?
Thank God.
So those, that heritage of conservation, of art, of great conversation. I mean, you have to also remember that at like 25 miles up north, you have the home of Andrew Jackson Downing.
Right. Who
is really the first American, widely known anyways, American landscape designer. And he worked with Olmsted, and they're creating these picturesque gardens and promulgating their ideas throughout America right here.
Right, exactly.
Right here.
Right. So it is very New York City centric, but yet it's ethereal because it's nature. It's, you know, you're outside of the city, and it's an opportunity to really create something.
Just one hour outside, which is pretty astounding.
Right. So on a more localized view, what you also have is the very specific 75 acres that Wright and his wife Elizabeth, who by the way was really essential to his success, she was a great marketing genius and help promote his whole idea of a branded lifestyle, you know.
Form follows function. And
that's very interesting to think about that, you know, so 50 years ago, you know, so ahead of its time.
Even more than 50 years ago. This was
60, 70 years ago.
She was, by the way, also related directly to Einstein. So I guess it's in the family, all this genius. Anyway, when they move up there, when they first buy the property, it's really a mess. It's been logged and quarried, and it's just a sort of dense forest.
Brambles.
Yeah. Right. And it's also a second generation forest, so it's not like,
it's not even good.
It's not even good. And over the years, so it's important to look at what he had to work with. Wasn't much. He had these stones, which were the major characteristic of the site. And he had wood. And he had this devastation, like these quarries in the middle of nothing.
So as an artist, what are you going to do with that?
And you know, over the years, his idea, of course, was to really evolve it into a garden of woodland plants, and to that help people experience the wonder of nature. But I think when he first got there, it wasn't much wonder.
Right.
And over the years, people would say to him, how did you find this amazing piece of property? You know, what? And he would be bemused.
Work, work, and more work. Right.
But he also really enjoyed the idea that people thought it looked so natural, mm-hmm. that it looked the way, you know,
nature intended. Right, right.
So
he really used the natural resources. He cleared the trees, he used the existing stones, and he created these kind of garden rooms. Is that right?
Yes, but I would say that he did everything very carefully.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was very important that he didn't go into a landscape and say, oh, there's a great view here, let's cut
bulldoze
down all these.
Yeah.
He would look and look and look and maybe cut a branch or maybe cut a tree, because he wanted to keep the naturalness mm-hmm. of the views and the outdoor rooms and the paths that mm-hmm. he created. But he does begin really by creating these paths, and that's what Manitoga is. It first and foremost is a garden of woodland paths.
Can you tell us a little bit about those paths?
Well, there are 11 of them, and they traverse the property in every which way, but many of them, most of them, are created by stone.
Okay.
So you can always know kind of where you're going.
Mm-hmm.
But off of each path, it's not like the path takes you to a view and then you walk back.
Mm-hmm.
It's much more
discovery along the way.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Hmm.
There are little outdoor rooms, little vistas, sometimes big vistas
mm-hmm.
that he's created. And it's always a sense of discovery.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you think of a garden room in the woods, what does that really mean? I mean, we think of garden rooms and we think of perennial beds.
Formality.
And hedges. And,
right.
It's nothing like that, right. But it really also depends. You really have to look.
Mm-hmm.
Like when
it's subtle.
It is subtle. And it's metaphorical.
Mm-hmm.
One of the places that everybody sees and loves when they first get there is called the Martha Graham Girls.
Okay.
And they're a collection of maybe, I don't know, between 6 and 10 white birch trees
mm-hmm.
that are planted every which kind of way, so they look like they're dancing.
Mm-hmm.
You have to pay attention to see that.
Right.
Once you see it, it's obvious and it's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many things like that all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And it's nice to go in the beginning with a guide to kind of help you see, and then go off on your own, because there's so many other places.
Right. And that's also the point, is the kind of self-discovery, you know, that the garden calls out to the viewer, is just the subtleness and
the quietness.
It's like taking a hike in Maine, you know, how sublime that can be. And it seems like, you know, there's all different kinds of landscapes in a Maine forest, and that's what's so beautiful, and it seems like that's what Manitoga is reminiscent of.
It is, but if you went to Maine and went for a walk in the woods, you would be discovering many things, but here it's compact.
Exactly, right. It's like a miniature forest, and so much more.
Yeah, it is in its own very careful way, very planned.
And there's Mary's Meadow.
There are many parts of the garden. Mary's Meadow was named after Wright's wife, and it was her favorite part of the garden. And you could, with a big clearing, it's the biggest clearing on the site, and you can see it from the house, although over time, that view shed has been eroded, and we all had a volunteer day up there last summer where we worked to clear that view
mm-hmm.
again. I mean, there are wildflower gardens and boulder groupings
and moss gardens
and a fern glen. There's so many wonderful ferns there. And
well, tell us a little bit about the plants that he used in his planning and planting of the garden.
Well, one of the things that's so really cool about Wright was how forward thinking he was. It's just really amazing. And that comes very much into play with his use of native plants. I mean, here it is, 1950, and he's saying, I don't want to introduce any foreign species here. Forget that.
Right.
But he's not buying the stock that you find at the local nursery center. Mm-hmm. He is identifying the plants that are already there, what plants that you can add to that group, and keeping it pretty much native and sustainable.
Mm-hmm. And local.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's face it, he has 75 acres. He's not going to put water drainage through 75 acres.
Right.
How is his plants going to survive? How are they going to multiply? They're going to do it if they like where they are.
Right.
So the most important plant and the most endangered plant is the hemlock,
mm-hmm.
which is, we'll talk about this a little bit later, but is getting a lot of problem from the woolly
adelphid.
And this is creating, so these hemlocks, of course, created the canopy of trees. So mm-hmm. when they go, the understory of trees is also being
affected, right?
And everything kind of, I mean, this is happening all over America, particularly on the East Coast, but
right.
You can really see it, painfully see it, at Manitoba.
And this house is on the National Register, is that right?
Yes.
The garden.
Yes, but, you know, even more important, it's on the National, it's a National Historic Landmark,
right.
Which is the highest such designation that you can get. And there are, in addition to that, very few gardens that are included as
right.
national.
Normally it's just the house.
Yes.
So.
I mean, that's a big thing that the Cultural Landscape Foundation harps about appropriately all the time, because mm-hmm. we need many more gardens, or not need, many more gardens deserve
they should
that,
be.
That status. That's,
yeah, mm-hmm. right.
But at the same time that the garden and the house are on the National Historic Landmark designated list, they're also... Manitoba is also on the list, the Cultural Landscape Foundation's landslide list, which points to the most endangered landscapes in America.
Mm-hmm.
And this is in part because of the problem with the hemlocks.
Well, we have to take a break 1 second. I want to come back and talk to you about those hemlocks because that's a big topic. You're listening to We Dig Plants on Heritage Radio Network. We'll be right back with Donna Dorian.
上を向いて歩こう涙がこぼれないように思い出す春の日一人ぼっちの歩く
Hi, welcome back. This is We Dig Plants, Heritage Radio Network. We're talking about Manitoga Garden, Russell Wright's house and garden up in
Garrison.
We're with Donna Dorian, and she's a board member, and talking about the landscape. So we, before the break, we were talking a little bit about the hemlock. Tell us a little bit more about the significance of that hemlock with regard to the landscape.
Well,
other than the native aspect to it.
Yeah, we were talking about how it's really seriously threatened up in Garrison and sort of all over America, but particularly in Garrison, where you have the woolly adelgid that's an insect that is boring into the hemlocks. And these are these trees are very hard to replace,
mm-hmm.
and it creates all kinds of problems, like should we put new ones in? And if you put new ones in, aren't they going to be
the same situation?
You're right. They're going to be infected by the same insect.
And there's not a lot of substitutes for a hemlock.
No, no. It's unusual or distinct.
Yeah. Yes. My parents have a row of hemlocks that are probably 75 feet tall, and they're probably 50 linear feet, and it's the same thing. It's like, what are you going to do? Cross your fingers and hope and pray, and
And the threat is of them is also heightened by the deer,
mm-hmm.
which of course are all over the place, and they feed upon the stressed hemlock's few seedlings. Mm-hmm. So what do you do about the deer? You can't.
Right. We that's a different show.
Right.
There's no shortage of opinions on that.
Right. But let's talk for a second about the kind of in that area, the industrialization and the extensive quarrying that happened as he was developing, or as he was, searching for a site for his house. Because he really regenerated the landscape. And that kind of picturesque.
Well, I think it's definitely Russell Wright was incredibly forward thinking, and I think I've said this many times already, and I probably will continue to say it's rather astonishing. I mean, here he is creating basically an ecological garden in the 1950s and the 1960s, which he's enhancing by his use of native plants and respecting the landscape.
Respect is exactly the word, because you pair that with Levittown, which is what was going on at that time, and wow, what a dichotomy that is.
Yeah.
Well, it's really interesting, the history to me here, because in the 19th century, mid-19th century, you have the picturesque tradition mm-hmm. coming over from England and being worked by the likes of Andrew Jackson, Downing, and Olmsted.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow we lose this thread.
Exactly.
In the industrial age, we have the Bauhaus, we have the invention of all these machines and the
materials.
New materials and the fascination with these products and these means of production that we never had before. But in that we lose this other very important train of thought.
Mm-hmm.
And Wright goes back to that train of thought. So instead of creating a Levittown,
mm-hmm.
okay, mm-hmm. which wipes the topography
clean and starts new, and
Wright works exactly the opposite way, regenerating the damaged landscape, mm-hmm. respecting it, having us live in it.
Mm-hmm.
You have to remember that he was also in the theater as a young guy.
Mm-hmm.
He went to Princeton. He studied law for his dad. And
so he's really a very well-rounded and very sensitive human, and used the natural resources to his best advantage.
I think that when I first started thinking about what would have happened if Wright's kind of idea towards the approach towards the landscape had taken hold in the 1950s.
Oh my God. Can you imagine how beautiful it would be?
We lost the thread again. you know, right. for another 70 years. Mm-hmm. Which and now we're coming back, picking it up again.
Yeah. Which is why people really need to go there.
Yeah. Yeah, they really do need to see it. That's why we wanted to have you on to talk about this, because it's so important. I mean, here we are, you know, in this new kind of changed world, you know, politically. And the whole idea is use what you have, stick with what you know, keep things close to the vest and see what happens rather than reaching out and controlling everything and crazy.
And also taking the time. How many years did he spend on working on that landscape? It wasn't, you
right.
know.
Oh, it's like 30 years.
Yeah,
it's
decades.
It's long, long, big picture perspective.
And I think a lot of times now when people want to make a garden, they want an instant. Mm-hmm. You know, they want an instant garden. They don't understand the process, you mm-hmm. know, mm-hmm. at all.
Well, you have to also remember that most people don't have 75 acres.
That's true, right. of course.
But on the other hand, what has happened between Russell Wright's passing in 1976 and the formation of the Russell Wright Design Board mm-hmm. is a lot of years where the garden just didn't have the manpower
direction
to, and, yeah. It was owned after his death by his daughter Annie Wright, who came to live there with her father mm-hmm. When she was two. Her mom there, the mother the wife had just died.
Okay.
And she grew up there and she inherited the house and she did what she could, but considering its real significance in the American landscape, I mean that figurative and literally, it was really too much and you really had to have an intervention. Now you have to have, there's active fundraising and Manitoba has won all kinds of grants mm-hmm. like this huge Save America grant, but it needs volunteers to come and help. On his volunteer days, I go all the time. It's a lot of fun. You work with this great group of people, and you work in the garden. There, you clean up after the fall. You take away the leaves. You work on the green roofs. You mine the meadows and the tour path. And all the dates for that are on the
website. We can post that,
yeah, too. We'll put it on our Facebook fan page right. after the show.
Manitoba not only offers this wonderful kind of tour of the landscape and its house, which is the subject of a whole nother
right show and
show
yeah discussion.
But it's also a hands-on way about learning how to address the woodlands,
mm-hmm. and learn about sustainability and. You know, like we were talking about earlier, using the things around you and how to really live that way instead of, you know, buying things at Target and, you know, like looking in garden supply catalogs and feeling like if I just had this, my garden would be all the much better, you know?
Well, it sounded like he did a lot of editing too. You know, so much of the process was editing to reveal
the landscape.
Yeah, mm-hmm. revealing features. This reminds me a little bit of the Eden Project in England, which I'm sure you're familiar with. They also, you know, reclaimed a quarry, a very damaged landscape, and they made not a botanic garden, but under glass and also out of doors, different environments. You know, that people could experience. You know, some that were native to, I think it's in the Cotswolds, you know, the real native Cotswold landscape. But it's so fascinating to me that he had done this so much earlier, that he was thinking about that, you know, because when I think about modernism, I don't think about that kind of garden, you
right,
know.
Right, right.
I think of gardens that are much more manicured or minimal. So it's a very interesting.
And geometric.
Right. Yeah.
Controlled.
And controlled. Right. Exactly. So it's very interesting to think about him. During that period, while other people were building these modernist glass, you know, industrial based things.
How many ways can I use bamboo?
Yeah.
And Acer palmatum.
Yeah. And gravel and rocks. And, you know, it's very interesting to hear about a very unique vision, you know. And I find it also interesting to think of him as using the experience as a set designer from the theater. I think that must have informed him enormously. You know, he understood the need. He understood how to present, you know, to make a stage in a way for nature.
Donna, let me ask you about the secret room, which is kind of a design feature. Can you explain a little bit about that? That's quite interesting to me.
Yeah, but I want to go back and connect it with the quarry, because the house, which is called Dragonhead.
That's a great name.
Yeah, it's Annie Wright's name for it. Is actually built on a ledge that overlooks the quarry. And the quarry must have been a big empty pit when Wright first got there. But what he did was he diverted all these streams in the landscape and created this really dramatic waterfall that fed the quarry and created a pond. So this is rather similar to the Eden Project, just years before. It is around the pond, okay, that the secret garden is. And I actually just walked it a couple weeks ago, even though my knees are sort of bad. It was a lot of fun. And it's tucked up sort of on the side of the quarry. But this is, it's said that when Wright didn't want to be with his guests, you know, he would escape there because no one would find him.
Right.
But they would probably find him today because of the damage to the hemlocks and to the understory of trees. And a lot of the path is much more open and revealed than it was in his day. I don't mean to say that Manitoba is a mess. It just
needs some attention.
Yes.
Right.
TLC.
Right. So you do welcome volunteers, and like we said, we'll post that. I myself might want to come up and hang out and do some work up
there.
That's
great. The next one is on May 22nd.
Okay. And yeah, there's a list of a couple of other ones coming up. And like, for instance, I'm reading over, there's on September 18th, I guess there's a volunteer day, gray and green, moss and boulders. Now, that is a good afternoon as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
And then mountain laurel is a very important plant in the garden and probably, the movie star of the garden.
Right.
At least in terms of flowering shrubs. Uh-huh. And Wright loved them and brought many more to the garden. They are, of course, a native. And to follow their tradition, he has these, the historic... the house holds the parties, mountain laurel festivals every year, and when the mountain laurels are, of course, in full bloom and in free food.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful.
We have mountain laurels in front of our house in Connecticut where I grew up, and every year my father says, "My, she puts on a good show." And I always think about that. They're so sculptural and just so gorgeous. And then when they're in flower, it's kind of like looking up somebody's dress, you know. It's so beautiful and secret and sculptural and tactile. It's amazing.
Yeah, really, they have amazing. Very beautiful flowers even before they open. They're interesting looking.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, yeah. So tell us a little more about some of the other outdoor rooms.
There are numerous rooms, as I said, all throughout the property. Some are, very obvious. Some are tucked away.
And they kind of relate to the rooms in the house, right?
There is enormous amount of rapport between the house and the garden. When the house was built by a man named David Levitt, who Wright had discovered or had chosen because he knew that he was fluent in Japanese design. And the whole issue of how much Japanese design is in the garden and in the house is sort of the subject of research. There's certainly a lot of reason to believe it could be there, but we can't find anything in writing from Wright that says that he was interested in the stones in the Japanese gardens or such and such.
And that aesthetic per se.
You know, maybe the stones are in such use because they were there.
Mm-hmm.
But also we know, you know, you have Frank Lloyd Wright going and building the Imperial Hotel in Tokyo. You have a lot of influence in the air of Japanese design during this period.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, the house, which is perched over the over the quarry, has a very Japanese design, very low roof.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually a green roof on top of his studio.
Green roof.
A real green roof.
A real green roof. One of the, there he was, another trendsetter.
Yeah. 1930?
Well, 1962, I think the house is finished. But still, that's pretty early for a green roof.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the studio is connected by with a pergola to the main living quarters. And outside of all the main, of all the living quarters, even the bathrooms, there are these wonderful terraced patios and views. And outside the studio, there's a little kind of cup garden.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've ever been to Innisfree.
Innisfree is gorgeous.
Which is sort of, I don't know if the two men ever knew each other. They didn't live that far apart.
Right,
but,
right.
But I would think not, just guessing, just because Wright was not really a landscape architect by training.
And let's hear it for design. Let's just say there were two really super smart people living up there together that didn't know each other, actually.
But the, you know, the, it's hard to imagine if there's a little cup garden outside his studio that he wasn't interested in. I mean, that's Chinese, but he wasn't interested in Asian design.
Right.
I mean, it's really interesting. After, you know, when you go to flea market and you buy all this stuff that says made in Japan?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm a dish junkie. Mm-hmm. I have tons of dishes from here and there. And many say made in Japan. That's really from Wright, in a way. The United States government sent him to Japan and to China, Cambodia, two other countries, Thailand, after the war, to teach, to help these societies get back on their feet through industrialization. As an industrial designer, he knew how to make things.
Here's a market. Here's how to do it.
Well, that's very interesting because when I, you know, porcelain in China, I mean, they had that tradition already. So, you know, for centuries.
But the mass production of it.
The mass production of it.
The industrialization
of it.
And he actually brought Jack Lenore Larson along with him on the trip, the fabulous, amazing textile designer. And so you see, there's a real reason to think that Wright was very interested in Asian design. And then he returns later to Japan to go and look at the gardens with his daughter. So that indoor-outdoor experience of the house and the garden, which garden design talks about all the time in every single issue.
Right.
The outdoors must relate to the indoor.
Yeah. If it's done right.
He got it. He got it right.
Yeah.
And there's all kinds of wonderful things in the house that Wright devised from nature, screens that have leaves in them, and doorknobs made out of pieces of wood. I mean, everywhere this idea of bringing the outside in is done
literally.
And no place better. I mean, the house is just chock full of take-home ideas of how you want to make kind of beautiful, sustainable interior.
Well, I think we have to have a tour and get up there then. I've never seen it. I've just, you know, trolled around the website several times, and I was delighted when we were speaking of having you as a guest that you wanted to talk about this subject, because, you know, there's not many people that really want to talk about design. They want to talk more about the plants or, you know, just replicating, a quick replication of some style that they love. But it's the sensitivity of that with garden making that concerns Carmen and I the most.
And the very personal nature of his style, mm-hmm. you know.
Which is really so influential. Yeah. And it's very quiet.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing. I'm sure many of our listeners, they don't know his name per se, but they certainly know his products and his, you know, ideologies versus actually association of how he lives, who he was, when he lived, you know, all those kind of factoids.
and not realizing how much he has influenced.
Mm-hmm. Everything that we do today, hopefully.
Yeah.
Well, if you make your way up there, which I highly recommend, there are many other things in the Hudson Highlands.
Sure.
To,
Innisfree.
Innisfree is a little far away. That's in Connecticut.
Right. But it's not, I mean.
What's closer is Boscobel, which mm-hmm. is this amazing historic house that was actually moved to the site. So it has a view of the Hudson. It's one of the most beautiful historic houses.
And Olana isn't too far.
Absolutely.
I love Olana.
Yeah.
And you're really near Cold Springs, mm-hmm. where there's a garden conservancy garden,
mm-hmm.
Stonecroft.
Yeah, Stonecroft.
Which mm-hmm. is really worth a view. Totally. Although you should call ahead in all these places to get the hours of.
Right.
That they're open.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Donna. And we're so excited that you are our guest. And like I said, we're going to post all these links to all of these places and to Manitoba and the visitation hours and visitation days. So we'll post that on our Fanbook page. Any last thoughts for us?
Oh, I just want to thank you for inviting me. This has been an awful lot of fun.
Great. Well, we really enjoyed having you on the show on We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. We thank you all for listening. Today, our show was produced by Jack Inslee, and Nat Wiener was our engineer. We've been recording from Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick's Brooklyn at 261 Moore Street. We'd like to thank our friends Super Compu Global and Paul Watling for our We Dig Plants theme music. Thanks for listening. Until next week, see you in the garden.
Thank you.
Thank you.